some of the smartest people in the world that I'm talking to. I think we could be on our way to reaching gold Bitcoin parity, which would mean we'd get over $900,000 per Bitcoin this cycle. Might seem insane, but as the amount of available supply drops and the demand increases, we are going to see Bitcoin go exponential. I think it could be the super cycle that we have all been waiting for. If we can get this legislative effort across the finish line. Think about it this way. U.S. government spent $1 billion on a U.S. jet, one single jet. I'm pretty sure they're going to spend $13 million on a single Bitcoin. The reason why Bitcoin matters as a strategic reserve to us here in the U.S. is because the dollar is losing popularity. Since 1991, we have seen the dollar drop in usage from 71% of the global economy down to 58%. And so this drop as the dollar reserve, being the dollar reserve currency of the world, is a big problem. And we need to start hedging our bets. We have BRICS on our heels, creating a totally new system. I mean, BRICS already today has 40% of the world's population. It has $30 trillion in GDP. We're only at $27 trillion in the US. Its purchasing power is nearly double at $60 trillion. We are at $30 trillion. So we need to be very careful as we proceed to give ourselves additional tools in our toolbox to defend ourselves from different types of extreme scenarios. Whenever there's an attempt to change the world order on money, really bad things happen. That's when you see major conflict break out. That's when you see World War I. That's when you see World War II. And that's probably where we could be headed towards a World War III type scenario if we don't have Bitcoin.
Bing bong. I am back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where we got the man behind the breaking news, the man, the myth, the legend, Dennis Porter in the house. But Dennis, there's been a ton of political hubbub about Bitcoin here recently with the election of President Trump, the Strategic Reserve, Cynthia Lummis, all that. But I want to start at the nation state adoption. You've tweeted out recently that you've talked to multiple nation states about developing potentially some sort of Bitcoin policy. So welcome to the show. And how many other countries are we going to get on a Bitcoin standard here in the year 2025?
Listen, the sky is the limit. Thank you for that kind introduction. I'm excited to be here on the show with you today. You know, all things are on the table when it comes to Bitcoin. Some of the smartest people in the world that I'm talking to, I think we could be on our way to reaching gold Bitcoin parity, which would mean we'd get over $900,000 per Bitcoin this cycle. Might seem insane, but as the amount of available supply drops and the demand increases, we are going to see Bitcoin go exponential. It is inevitable that Bitcoin goes exponential, and humans don't really have a great way of understanding like exponential curves. They have a hard time imagining how quickly Bitcoin could go up. I think this is just the very beginning of the bull market. I don't even think we have really even gotten started yet. And yes, I am talking to a number of different lawmakers all across the world. I had the great fortune of traveling the planet recently for the first time in my life. December 2023 was the first time that I was in Europe. It was the first time I was anywhere in the world other than US and Mexico. But now I have been into a number of different countries and have been invited to participate in educating lawmakers all across the globe who are very interested in Bitcoin. Certainly to your comment on Trump and the election results, I think people are very excited in the Bitcoin space about the outcome of the election. I think that there's a lot more to be said about the outcome of some Senate races than there is the outcome of the presidential race. Of course, you're always going to want a president that supports Bitcoin versus stands in the way of it. And we certainly have that in this next administration from all we can tell. But there's some races that happened in this last election here in the U.S. that I think in a way were almost like more important than the presidential race, because it set the tone for what'll happen if you stand in the way of Bitcoin politically. I've said for some time that it's becoming political suicide to be opposed to Bitcoin, to be opposed to this ecosystem. And we've seen that happen in real time and become a reality in some of these Senate races from the last election. The one that's the most important is the Sherrod Brown, Bernie Moreno race in Ohio, where almost inarguably Sherrod Brown lost his race because of his opposition to crypto and Bitcoin. Sherrod Brown has been a member of Congress for many years. He is the head of Senate Banking, very powerful committee, very powerful senator. And it's hard to come up with any other reason for why he lost his seat, except for that he wanted to join with Elizabeth Warren to oppose this technology, which is unfortunate. I think Elizabeth Warren should be a huge advocate for Bitcoin. I think she should be one of the most pro-Bitcoin senators that we have. She loves to take on the banks. She loves to fight for consumers. I think she just got some people that are not helping her understand the difference between Bitcoin and a lot of this other stuff out there. You know, I talk to a lot of Republicans, and I also talk to a lot of Democrats. And Democrats see the potential for Bitcoin if you give them the education and you get them in a good position to see the value of the technology. We just haven't had, I think, someone that Elizabeth Warren trusts getting close enough to her to help her see the value of the technology. But yes, I think those things are changing. The tides are shifting. We're going to see legislation not only be introduced in more Republican states in 2025, we are also going to see that take place in Democrat states as well, because they see the value of this tech just as well as Republicans can. I think that Republicans benefited a lot from libertarians joining their ranks from 2008 to 2010. Right when Bitcoin was launching, you had a massive amount of ex-Ron Paul folks inject themselves into the Republican Party and help to, I think, create a message for Bitcoin within the Republican ranks. Clearly worked, and now they're off to the races. Republicans are leading the world. They're leading the country on being pro-Bitcoin. But I promise you that the other side of the aisle and even independents are not going to be far behind trying to advocate for this technology. It truly is a Bitcoin. It's truly for everyone. So very excited about where we are. Tons of opportunity in the space. Of course, can't wait to talk about more of it with you here on the show.
Yeah, of course. And there's a lot to unpack out there. But first, the first thing that you mentioned, you just kind of glossed over it. You're telling me 900K Bitcoin this cycle. You're talking to a lot of people who believe it's going to surpass gold. So I know you're talking to people with that, but are you going to go out on a limb? Are you believing that we're going to pass gold this cycle? Is this the super cycle?
I think it could be the super cycle that we have all been waiting for. If we can get this legislative effort across the finish line to be able to make strategic Bitcoin reserves here at the state level and here at the federal level in the US, there is no reason to believe that we might see a runaway price on Bitcoin. Governments don't care about price. They are not price sensitive. Buyers like you and me, you know, we can be very price sensitive. The average person, I would say probably you and me less so, because we're, you know, in the space, we're always buying Bitcoin. But a lot of the people that are like trying to make their decision on when they're going to enter the marketplace, they see the Bitcoin going up over 100K. And, you know, some people that makes them like, oh, wow, I missed my opportunity. This is what we always hear. I missed my opportunity. Governments don't think that way. They'll buy Bitcoin at any price. They'll buy it at 100K. They'll buy it at 500K. They'll buy it at a million. They'll be buying it all the way to 13 and million and plus, because they don't have to be concerned with the price when they know that they're competing against other nation states. Think about it this way. US government spent $1 billion on a US jet, one single jet. I'm pretty sure they're going to spend $13 million on a single Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, that's all fair to say. But before we dive deep into the US, I want to dive into the different nation states and how important you think this is. Do you think that there's almost like a race? You said you met with somebody, one in Europe, one in LATAM. Do you think a lot of people are paying attention that Bukele and Malay, to a lesser extent, are doing kind of almost flipping their countries on the head and trying to emulate that in order to, you know, whether it's in LATAM or Europe, make their countries prosper?
Listen, I just got back from El Salvador. It's a great country. My parents have lived there for 15 years, and there's so much economic growth taking place in that country, so much opportunity. The crime is at an all-time low. You know, certainly there are some people that believe that, you know, there are other ways to approach these things, but Bukele has had a lot of success, and he has shown that if you are willing to fight for your country, then you can make a difference. I think that's what we're trying to show here in the US as well with Satoshi Action. If you're willing to fight, get in the game, you have the right strategy, the right relationships, you can make a big, big difference in the political space. You know, TBD on Malay, on what he does with his nation, you know, certainly going through some growing pains right now, but I think they're going to end up being on the other side of this thing. They're going to end up in a much better position. But as far as the rest of the world, there is, yes, a global competition, a global race, so to speak, for adoption of this technology. People need to remember that the more people that buy Bitcoin, the more likely is that eventually some of those Bitcoiners are going to make it into political office. And from what we can tell at Satoshi Action, that has started to take place. We are seeing lawmakers all across the world, lawmakers here in the United States, winning their offices, some of them for the first time, reaching out to us saying, I want to work on strategic Bitcoin reserve legislation. We never had this before. This is what I said recently to some other folks. We've never had lawmakers reaching out to us when we started this organization, we always had to be reaching out to them, always trying to find new lawmakers to talk to. When we first started, it was like almost impossible just to even get a meeting, but we kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And eventually we were able to have a lot of success, but now it's completely different. It's shifted. We are receiving inbound from lawmakers for the first time ever who are saying, I want to add Bitcoin to the balance sheet. I want my pensions to buy Bitcoin. I want a strategic Bitcoin reserve. So that bodes really well for our opportunity to be successful, because we now, instead of having to find Bitcoin champions, they're finding us.
Now, how much do you think the price plays a role into that? Do you think it's the price, or do you think it's more so, you know, what other countries are doing and you know, maybe the noise that Trump is making with this strategic reserve plan?
I mean, price always plays a role. And I think that's the genius of Satoshi. He knew that in order for this technology to be adopted, there needed to be a way to have these constant supply, constant price shocks, which are created by the supply being cut in half every 4 years. The halving is the most, probably one of the most important components that drives Bitcoin adoption, because it essentially forces the price up in a, because of the supply being completely cut in half, or the new supply being completely cut in half. This is what drives the cycles that we enter into every 4 years. Now we may be moving out of those, but for the time being, they are in place and they have been a major driver for the conversation. I mean, the reason why the media all of a sudden starts covering Bitcoin every 4 years is because the price explodes. So the price is a big part of the magic, but the global adoption, the interest by lawmakers, certainly members of Congress, like Senator Lummis putting their entire career on the line for Bitcoin, that provides a lot of political cover for other people in the space. And now Bitcoin has gone up. Those people were right. The Bitcoiners are right again. I think you're going to see more and more and more lawmakers with more and more interest towards this technology as we move forward.
Yeah. And I mean, you mentioned Senator Cynthia Lummis, like she's been a huge proponent. She's been coming to the Bitcoin conference for multiple years now. And she actually, you know, wrote the bill, the Bitcoin Act of 2024, which is the fourth most viewed bill, you know, that's out there right now. So how big do you think that is? Senator Cynthia Lummis's role in all of this? And even, you know, did she potentially get in RFK's ear and get in Trump's ear in order to kind of push this forward more on a federal level as well?
Senator Lummis's office has been a huge part of making Bitcoin adoption take place here in the US. She and her office are also really involved at the state level in Wyoming before she moved up to the federal level. And the members of her office, the staffers that work for her, were also very involved in moving the ball forward in Wyoming before going to the federal level. So there's a lot, they've been pretty integral to the adoption of Bitcoin from a political perspective. You know, Senator Cynthia Lummis was the person who said, thank God for Bitcoin on the Senate floor, first time in history that ever happened. And, you know, there's a reason why we gave her the Thank God for Senator Lummis Award, because she's just been such a strong advocate for this technology. Yes, they definitely are playing a major role. They're constantly talking to other lawmakers. They are constantly trying to get people on board with the strategic Bitcoin reserve legislation. And so they are in DC, very much a big part of making sure Bitcoin adoption takes place.
Yeah. And so you've tweeted out about that. It's almost a race to get the states on board for a strategic reserve at the state level opposed to the federal level. You know, you've also tweeted out that you think that Trump needs to almost, you know, do that as a on day one, try to get the strategic reserve bill placed. Now, I want you to call your shot here, Dennis. Do you think a state's going to get, you know, a strategic reserve bill for Bitcoin passed prior to President Trump getting in office? I believe it's on the 20th of January.
It's going to be close, but it's the thing about these state legislatures is that they're very short. So things happen very rapidly. And so if Trump doesn't do, you know, a day one executive order, or very early on when he's at, you know, when he's taken over the Oval Office, we will absolutely get one of these bills across the finish line before he's able to get anything done. So it's really up to him. You know, does he want to pass does he want to push forward a executive order that enacts a strategic Bitcoin reserve? If he does on day one, he might beat us, maybe. But there's also a possibility that we pass one of these things very rapidly. There is a state we're working with right now that is a near 100% guarantee that we get the bill passed into law. And that is going to happen very fast. And then there's going to be many other states that are lining up, and also, again, other countries lining up as well.
What are the states that are leading the way? Can you divulge any of them?
Only one we can divulge is Pennsylvania. That one has certainly led the charge. They were the first one to make the introduction, first time in history that a state introduced a strategic Bitcoin reserve piece of policy. And we are proud to be the ones that were behind that effort and also creating the model policy that was used for that introduction. But we'll see who comes out next. I think you're going to be very happy, though, with the states that are taking a look at this legislation.
Well, it seems like a lot of states have already been very friendly to Bitcoin, especially like the state of Texas, right? I mean, a lot of hash rate is in the state of Texas, so it would make sense to kind of integrate it that way. You know, outside of the strategic reserve bills, what other policies do you kind of foresee that states become more friendly? Is it something more along the lines of mining, transactions? What do you see as like kind of the way that this is playing out? Or is it, you know, a combination of both, just kind of depending on which state it is? Maybe one will push for more of the peer-to-peer electronic cash. One will push a little bit more of the mining. Is it going to be a collective effort? How is this going to play out in the US in this next year?
It's a really great question, Brandon. And I was just talking to a lawmaker moments ago about the importance of focusing on the policy issues, which will matter more for their state. I think, in my opinion, especially with red states, you're going to see a lot of this early latching on to the strategic Bitcoin reserve legislation, partly because Trump and Lummis and others have endorsed it. I mean, we've seen Democrats endorse it as well, like Ro Khanna. But in general, Republican legislatures at the state level are much more attuned to the idea of adding sound money to their treasury. The reason being is because there's already a massive sound money movement amongst red states where they're advocating to add gold and silver to the balance sheet of those states. Some of them already have that pushed that legislation through successfully. So adding Bitcoin doesn't seem like that big of a jump to them. Now, if you go over to some of the Democrat held states, some of the blue states, there definitely is interest. I mean, I had a lawmaker today ask me about it, a Democrat lawmaker asked me about doing strategic Bitcoin reserve legislation in a deep blue state. But one of the things that I said to him is, you know, the bigger focus for you guys is, you know, probably going to be on the renewable energy side, because there's so much renewable energy. A lot of these blue states have really, really high mandates as far as like what percentage they want of their grid to be renewable energy and clean energy. And renewable energy just really, really has so many great attributes. But one of the bad parts about renewable energy is that it is really geographically dependent. And so you have to place renewable energy really far away from demand centers, oftentimes where the wind is strong and the sun is bright. Well, you have to transport that power back to demand centers. Otherwise, it doesn't get used. Well, that's what's happening right now. We built all this renewable energy far away from demand centers, and we've had a hard time building the transmission lines. So you have a ton of stranded, you know, wind and solar energy in the middle of the, you know, middle of nowhere, essentially. Well, Bitcoin mining plays a really quick role here, a really important role here, and it can jump in and it can co-locate right next to wind and solar, monetizing all that excess green energy that it will be created, delivering better ROIs, and also potentially saving some of these renewable energy sites on top of all of that. So that's an area that I think Democrats will care a lot more about, because they're so invested into clean energy. Certainly some of them are going to try SBR language, but I think that's going to be Republicans that try that first. And then you're going to see a lot more clean energy work done by Democrats.
One of the most crooked industries, most fiat industries there is the health insurance industry. Let's be honest, you don't even need health insurance. If you could find somebody that would help you find awesome doctors, negotiate your bills, and fund those bills through a peer-to-peer funding platform, would you take it? That sounds pretty appealing to me, and that's why I've joined forces with CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is a place that you could do that all in one. One giant place, you can have a group of peers where they will help you find the best healthcare that you need. On top of all that, I can help get you a discount to get you on your feet and get everything started. You can use promo code GREENCANDLE for 3 months at $99. And with all of this, you will get the healthcare you need. You don't have to worry about going through to the doctor, negotiating, everything like that. Did you hit your deductible? Did you not? Is this insurance company going to cover this claim? Is it not? You don't have to worry about any of that stress. And you could just get CrowdHealth behind you, where they can help you get the number one place to have a health insurance alternative. But join the revolution. Go to joincrowdhealth.com. Tell them that Green Candle sent you. and join me and the rest of the great CrowdHealth users in this peer-to-peer funding platform. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. Do you think that the two parties are going to find almost like some common ground here when it comes to Bitcoin, whether it's, you know, all the policies, whether you're, you know, you're lining out the green energy policies or more of the strategic Bitcoin reserve? Because, you know, as you kind of stated, it's almost like political suicide at this point to go against Bitcoin in the crypto industry. So do you see them almost finding a common ground on this, and there's not going to be as much, I guess, political jabbing back and forth when it comes to Bitcoin and the policies surrounding it?
So I've said for some time that I think we need to get out of an era where we're debating over whether or not we do Bitcoin and then enter a new era where we debate over how we do Bitcoin. I think that's happening right now, right in front of our eyes. And so lawmakers are certainly going to battle and battle fiercely over how we do Bitcoin. But luckily in that scenario, that's sort of a win-win scenario, right? Because if governments are competing over how to do Bitcoin and they're out competing each other and they're doing better and better at it, then we all benefit. Bitcoin benefits. Bitcoin grows. The use cases for Bitcoin grow. So I'm looking forward to a world where we compete over how to do Bitcoin. I think we are entering that world as we speak. Things like strategic Bitcoin reserves will be probably a big push for Republicans in the beginning. But in the future, it'll be things like accessibility and making sure that the underprivileged and the unbanked have access to Bitcoin. That'll be a big initiative for Democrats. But that's great. That's great for the price of Bitcoin, because the more Bitcoin is used, the more demand there is for Bitcoin. That's going to lift the price up. And additionally, Democrats are going to be very, very keen to want to advance Bitcoin mining as a solution for renewable energy. And Republicans are going to be more about all the above. They're going to say, well, we like it for all the energy assets. So that'll be a very vigorous debate that takes place here in the United States over the next 10 years.
Oh, okay. So you think this is going to be kind of like a longer, slower process where, you know, it'll be playing out over a decade, maybe a decade plus, opposed to getting a lot of these policies in right away?
I mean, it's just never going to end. Like the parties were made to compete for your vote. So if they're going to compete for your vote on Bitcoin, they're going to come up with different ideas for how they think we should do Bitcoin. That means that you're going to have likely Republicans saying, plug it into every coal plant and gas plant and wind and solar and everything. They're going to like that. Democrats are going to say, well, no, we should advance clean energy because we want to reduce our emissions footprint. And that's going to be a battle that takes place for, it's never going to end. These battles don't stop. The battle lines just get redrawn. So instead of saying, okay, we're pro Bitcoin, you're anti Bitcoin, it's we're both pro Bitcoin, but we think we should mine Bitcoin differently. That battle's never going to end. That's going to be like a forever battle that we have. But ultimately, that means that we're fighting over how we can use Bitcoin, how we can advance it. And there's going to be different opinions, but ultimately, Bitcoiners win in the end.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. Hey, we're all talking about Bitcoin at this point in time, and especially politicians and mainstream media. And, you know, we alluded to it a little bit at the beginning. It's, you know, a lot is driven on the price. Now, I want to play devil's advocate for you. Maybe the you know, super cycle doesn't happen this cycle. We still run into these four-year cycles. So, you know, this year, say 25 is a great year. Then 26, you know, for some reason, Bitcoin does the green, 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 red. Like it keeps the continual pattern, and we have kind of a down year. Do you think that could negatively hurt a lot of the policies that would be, you know, I guess like up for it at that time? And do you think that, you know, that would play a major role? Or do you think that, you know, that the sound principles and, you know, the policies being created now and drafted up now are just looking at Bitcoin in a positive light, and there's not going to be a lot of swaying from that?
I when it comes to policy, the excitement around the price, the excitement around from the political spectrum absolutely plays a major role in what you can get across the finish line. And the thing that we at Satoshi Action are always trying to do is trying to modulate how we approach it, the policy perspective, based on the level of excitement and the level of interest by lawmakers. So even though some more innovative and cutting edge policies might fall outside of the spectrum of what lawmakers are willing to pass into law, there will always be something that we can advance. And so that's our goal at Satoshi Action, is always to identify where that is. Where is that intersection of interest where we can get things across the finish line? I think we've done a really good job of that so far. We passed two bills into law in our first cycle, two bills to law in our second cycle. And I can nearly guarantee that we'll pass at least two maybe four bills into law at minimum on this cycle. We've never really actually been in a bull market when we've been passing legislation. So there's, in theory, our win rate could skyrocket just like the price of Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the price would definitely help. It seems like it's going to be that. And, you know, the smart people that you're talking to, if they wanted to pass gold and everything like that, this cycle and market cap, I mean, I think the possibilities are endless. But, you didn't mention a few states, but you mentioned Pennsylvania, but I want to dive into Ohio, which you mentioned a little bit earlier, because obviously J.D. Vance came from Ohio. So there's a lot of, you know, movement in that state after, you know, now he's the vice president elect here coming up soon. But it seems very forward thinking. Is Ohio going to be one of the ones that leads the way here? And, you know, why or why not?
I mean, Ohio's in a great place. It's got a lot of great folks there working overtime to move the state the right direction. And yeah, there's a number of people that have come from there. J.D. Vance is from there. Vivek is from there. And you have also Bernie Moreno, who's a new senator. You have also a number of different members of Congress, like Warren Davidson, who's also from Ohio, who's very pro-Bitcoin. So Ohio is, yeah, incredibly well-positioned to be able to do things for Bitcoin. So I can't share any more details, but I think people will certainly be happy to hear that Ohio is in a great position.
Okay. All right. Fine, Dennis. You won't give me the secret sauce here just yet, but I want to talk about the Strategic Reserve and how important you think that is for just the U.S. economy in general. You had a great tweet about, the Strategic Reserve would pay off debt, protect Bitcoin mining, help prevent an economic crisis, improve our geopolitical stance, boost innovation, grow the economy, and hedge against BRICS. So 7 points. Is that like just the 7 points that you think that when you're speaking with these lawmakers that they bring up, or is this more of, I guess you kind of educating them when they're bringing up their strategic reserve? Like, where is the education level, I guess, is maybe a better question here when it comes to the lawmakers around the strategic reserve bill?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's important to take a step back when you're talking about strategic reserves and understand why we have strategic reserves in the first place. So there's a number of different important components to the strategic reserves that we have today. We have ones for gold, we have ones for oil, we have ones for uranium, we have reserves for rare minerals, we even have reserves for medical supplies. All of those are very important reserves that help secure our country's national security from a certain perspective. They also help to stabilize our economy. And in the case of medical supplies, if we have a massive medical emergency, like a global pandemic, they are supposed to be there to help us overcome the obstacles that are created in those, 50 or 100 year events. Unfortunately, as many people know, in this country, we did not have enough medical supplies when the pandemic hit. And we saw nurses and we saw doctors wearing reusable masks again. They were wearing the same masks over and over again. They were wearing trash bags over themselves because there just was nothing available to them. So it created a really, really big problem in this country when we did not have those supplies that we needed for that national emergency. But there's additional reasons why we have these types of reserves in place. Think about the oil reserve. It serves a couple of different purposes. Let's think about a scenario where we might enter into a global conflict. We're going to need those oil reserves to make sure in those early days of that global conflict that we're actually able to empower our military forces. Also, think about OPEC Plus. OPEC Plus has shown hostility towards the U.S. It oftentimes tries to get in the game of fixing the price of oil. But because we have the strategic reserve, we know that there is another bargaining chip in our at our table that we can use in those times when OPEC Plus might be trying to show hostilities, which actually prevents them from being as hostile. Beyond that, I talked a lot about the need for using Bitcoin as a strategic hedge. Of course, we have the reserves that are currently in place, but why do we need Bitcoin specifically? The reason why Bitcoin matters as a strategic reserve to us here in the US is because the dollar is losing popularity. Since 1991, we have seen the dollar drop in usage from 71% of the global economy down to 58%. And so this drop as the dollar reserve, being the dollar reserve currency of the world, is a big problem, and we need to start hedging our bets. We have BRICS on our heels, creating a totally new system. I mean, BRICS already today has 40% of the world's population. It has $30 trillion in GDP. We're only at $27 trillion in the US. Its purchasing power is nearly double at $60 trillion. We are at $30 trillion. So we need to be very careful as we proceed to give ourselves additional tools in our toolbox to defend ourselves from different types of extreme scenarios. And one of those extreme scenarios is that BRICS supersedes the United States as the global leader of the economic system that we live under. And so Bitcoin is a hedge against that sort of system. Bitcoin is also, of course, a hedge against inflation. I don't think I need to get too much into the weeds on that one. I think most of the people listening in here have heard that story. But having Bitcoin is really important, not just for the federal government to hedge against inflation, but particularly for the states, because the states, they don't have a money printer. They don't have unlimited money. They have fixed budgets. And when I travel all across this country, those budgets have been massively constrained by the inflation that we've gone through. School budgets, there's not enough money. Nobody can fix the roads. Nobody can pay for new infrastructure. If those states that went through that event would have had 5% or 10% in Bitcoin in their rainy day fund or in their directly in their treasuries, they would not have had to worry about the crunch that we're going through right now, because the Bitcoin that would have had would have quadrupled in value, making up for that significant shortfall that they've had in planning for the budget. So there's a million reasons why I think we need some of these reserves at the state level. I think it's a little bit more important, but certainly from a NatSec perspective, having it at the federal level is critically important as well.
The number one way to buy and sell Bitcoin is through Unbanked. They require no KYC. And on top of that, if you sell, you get zero fees. That's right, zero fees with that withdrawal. There's cash at over 28,000 locations. You could get this money directly to your PayPal, Venmo, or bank instantly with no wait time. And they have in-house support in the United States. If you got any questions for them, they've been an independent company operating since 2014. So they've been a trusted brand in the industry. And on top of all of this, to start off the new year, they're partnering up with me to give you a raffle that will take place January 31st to see if you could win a chance at $210. All you got to do is sign up on this app using this link below, unbanked.com/greencandle. Go there, download the app. And then on top of that, you could potentially win $210. That's a lot of sats, and it's going to be less and less sats the longer you wait, folks. So go ahead and sign up today. And enough from me. Let's get back to the show.
What do you take of, the Department of Government Efficiency that we got here going? Because it seems like, Elon's going to slash a lot of these departments and try to, lower government spending. And it sounds like, from a lot of the people that you're talking about, needs to kind of help fund some of these projects. Is it just because they're inefficient and that's kind of, the narrative going around, or is, something that the Department of Government Efficiency could actually be a negative here in the run through the bumps and bruises of, trying to be more efficient and utilize the money and the reserves and everything else, a little bit better than we have in the past?
Look, I'm very pro, improving government efficiency. I think there's rampant government waste. I don't think necessarily we need to spend less money as much as we need to just be more efficient with the way we spend that money. In general, the reason why people are so pissed off about how much money they pay in taxes is because they don't feel that they get an ROI on those taxes. You go to other countries where they actually spend the money efficiently, people love their taxes. They're like, feel like they're actually going to help boost the economy and boost the local infrastructure. The roads are beautiful and paved. The streets are clean. There is a lot of opportunity around them. And so they feel better about paying the taxes because they're actually getting an ROI on the money invested into that system. So I definitely support any type of improvement in efficiency. I think we definitely need to be spending the money better here in the US. As someone who's traveled across the US at the state level and talked to governments, you can see waste all over the place. And everybody knows that nobody wastes more money than the federal government, or at least they're just very inefficient with the way they spend it.
Yeah, I mean, that's all fair to say, but I want to get back into what you were saying about OPEC and OPEC Plus. and our oil reserves, right? Because you think that, I mean, you were kind of describing a unique scenario where, you know, obviously we've depleted the oil reserves over time. We need some way to build it up. But how do you see, I guess, the potential of like some of these geopolitical conflicts that we've got going on? I mean, everybody's aware, you know, Ukraine, Russia, all these other things kind of playing out here across the globe. How important do you think is playing to, you know, some of these potential geopolitical conflicts, whether it's, you know, the U.S. kind of hedging itself against that or, you know, some other countries around the globe?
I mean, it could be really important if we enter into a dynamic where there's a sticking point between BRICS and the U.S. You know, whenever there's an attempt to change the world order on money, really bad things happen. That's when you see major conflict break out. That's when you see World War One. That's when you see World War Two. And that's probably where we could be headed towards a World War Three type scenario if we don't have Bitcoin. Because at a certain point, BRICS and the U.S., if hostilities continue to persist, are going to say, well, you have to be inside my system in order to operate. You need to be fully inside BRICS or fully inside the SWIFT U.S. system. Well, eventually those things are going to collide and they're not going to want to be interoperable. They're going to want to force people to be in their system only. So Bitcoin could act as a critical component to keeping interoperability between those two systems by acting as a third rail to the global financial order.
Yeah, I mean, that's very well put. And I think that that's kind of, you know, the way that we see things playing out here. But I guess let's get into RFK, because he seems like he's done his homework. And over the past year, you know, his speech at the Bitcoin conference last year compared to his speech at the Bitcoin conference this year seems like, you know, a drastic difference. We'll get into President Trump's speech a little bit afterwards, but you know, how important of a role do you think that he's going to play in just like advocating for Bitcoin going forward? I know he's more on the health and that kind of aspects of things, but from what you're hearing, is he kind of being an advocate for more of the Bitcoin policy and things along those lines as well?
He's definitely a strong voice for it. I think the interesting part about my understanding of RFK was that, you know, I got him to speak at the Mining Disrupt conference, which for those of you that don't know, Mining Disrupt is the world's largest Bitcoin mining conference. They're going to have another one here March 25th to the 27th. But two years ago, actually, I got him to speak two conferences ago. So whatever, that's a year and a half, I think. He spoke, I interviewed him. It was a great conversation. I feel like back then he was just getting to understand Bitcoin, but he did have a very strong perspective on it. He owned some Bitcoin at that point. And then you kind of transport forward to the Bitcoin conference later, I think it was later that year. And they really wanted to do a big Bitcoin push. They did a big Bitcoin speech. He talked a lot about Bitcoin. It was a really well written speech. I'm sure he played a part in writing it. He seems to understand Bitcoin. And also he was the first presidential candidate in US history to accept Bitcoin via the Lightning network. In fact, that was the one that helped their group do that. And then Vivek, of course, was later the evening and he did the same thing. And we also helped his team accept Bitcoin as the first Republican in history to accept Bitcoin via the Lightning Network. But then you go forward a little bit further from there. And at this last conference, he jumped out and was the first to announce that he was going to create a strategic Bitcoin reserve. I think it was a much bigger number. And then there was a dinner later that night that I had the chance of going to where he came and spoke. It was interesting because it was like a private dinner. And so he was a little more relaxed. There wasn't cameras all over him. And he just gave this very like eloquent speech about how he felt like he was a real Bitcoiner and that despite everything that happened, like he really felt like super connected to the Bitcoin community. I love to see it. I love that he is so pro Bitcoin and that he's continuing to advocate for it. I think regardless of where he is in the administration, he will certainly play a role in being an important voice that supports Bitcoin.
That's amazing. Well, what were some of the things that he, you know, if you can recall that he felt are the reasonings why he felt so connected to it? Was it more of, you know, maybe the freedom aspect of it? I mean, I know a lot of Bitcoiners are very much like health conscious, anti-seed oils. So they really resonate with his messaging on that. Like, you know, do you recall maybe a couple reasons why he said he felt so connected to the Bitcoin space?
It was certainly the people, you know, that was the interesting part about it. It was less about the technology and it was more about the people. So he said he felt really connected to the people within the space. I think a lot of people come into the space, they feel the same way. They feel a sense of connection with this very independently minded thinking group of people. That was a part that he had commented on. A lot of very independent thinkers, people that do their own research. They don't get told what to do. Bitcoin tends to attract that type of person to it. And he seemed very focused on the people.
Gotcha. Well, that makes, I mean, I had a Bitcoiner that I feel like I haven't hit it off with, like, just off the bat, and felt like I've known him for years, in a while. So, I mean, I could definitely resonate with that message, but I want to get into more of Donald Trump, right? And he obviously spoke at the Bitcoin conference, but it almost seemed like to me it was more of another rally. It wasn't really necessarily Bitcoin centric. He kind of went all over the place as he does. You know, I think it was very encouraging for him to see the importance to come to the Bitcoin conference. Now, where do you think he is kind of on this, I guess, like, education level when it comes to Bitcoin? And outside of him putting the right people around him, which it seems like he's sort of starting to do, you know, him personally, if you've maybe like heard him talk or have some people that are in his ear, you know, where do you think he is in the Bitcoin education standpoint, and, you know, how important he views this as an issue?
It's definitely something that is being talked about for sure. And that he has an interest in. I think, to me personally, if I had to guess though, I think his family is the one that's driving the conversation. When I was recently listening in on a Twitter Spaces, it wasn't that long ago, but Don Jr. came on and he was using the word crypto, of course, when he was talking, but he kept saying things that made me realize that he does tend to understand the value of what Bitcoin can offer. He kept talking about how there are family was debanked. A lot of times they couldn't access financial services, and that Bitcoin can act as a tool to ensure access, and that it can give the ability for people who have been politically persecuted to participate in the global economy. And I think that like strikes at the heart of why Bitcoin is so important, that you can't be forced out of the financial system. You know, you can really sort of like doom your political opponents by kicking them out of the financial system. And it's a power that is a godlike power, that whoever is in control of the financial system, they can wield that power against their political opponents and just eliminate them theoretically from the financial system if they wanted to. Now with Bitcoin, that makes it impossible to do that. And I think that creates a better system with better checks and balances. Don Jr. seemed to be the one who understood that strongly. I haven't heard Trump speak about it the way Don Jr. has. So if I had to guess, I would guess that certainly some of the family members are the ones driving the conversation.
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty, but simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm going to help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at the Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign. Now, what do you take into their, I guess, stance on like more of the dabbling their toes into the crypto kind of industry opposed to staying Bitcoin only? Do you think that, you know, the policies are going to stay more Bitcoin only and be like, you know, somewhat friendly to the crypto industry? Or is it, you know, the policies are going to be just more Bitcoin centric?
I mean, we'll have to wait and see for sure what comes out of it. I think there were a lot of Bitcoiners that didn't like the crypto play. But, you know, we don't really know exactly what the effort will look like, but certainly I had a lot of folks, even donors, that were not super happy about the crypto play. But this is kind of the difference, I think, again, going back to Republicans versus Democrats, that you're going to get is, I think that Republicans are really going to be sort of like deregulation or like lack of regulation, for Bitcoin and crypto, which, you know, is good for growth. But at the end of the day, like, we need to protect consumers from some of these scams. Like, we can't expect people to be able to understand these markets. Like, there are people with less of an education who are going to be exposed to very, very sophisticated scams if we're not careful. So I think in a way where there's a world where Republicans are acting in trying to open up markets, creating more freedom in the markets, and Democrats are trying to operate on the, you know, let's protect consumers. And you'll get a back and forth movement on those two parallels for some time. Republicans are going to be like, open it all up. And Democrats are going to say, you know, let's open it up, but let's be more careful about the approach.
Interesting. So yeah, I guess the Republicans are more on the side of like the open market, so to speak, where Democrats want a little bit more regulation and kind of trying to eliminate the cryptocurrencies from making it, I guess, like being the accessibility to making crypto tokens. But I mean, to be honest, I don't really see a way of them to try to eliminate, I guess, like the creation of crypto tokens. I mean, maybe I'm wrong. Do you like, there's such a low barrier to entry? It's just simply creating code. A lot of these projects are all open source. So do you see like a way that they're able to, I guess, regulate that, or would it just be making it more difficult, maybe doing something like FTX, creating some company in the Bahamas, and then, you know, it's just not able to operate here in the US specifically? So yeah, I guess long-winded question to ask, do you see a possibility of that becoming a reality where it's harder to make some of these crypto tokens slash projects or whatever the hell they want to call them these days?
I don't think you can make it impossible to make them. I think you can make it practically impossible to sell them. So, you know, we already limit access to US markets a number of different ways with various types of exchanges, you know, Binance and the like. You know, Binance had to create a Binance US. There are a lot of other exchanges that we have restricted access to the US market. So the US, and I think other major markets, can restrict access, certainly, to some of these more egregious scams and create a better opportunity for consumers. Now, I'm in the bucket of thinking that, you know, we just need a lot more education as well. So we shouldn't just rely on, you know, restricting access as much as we should rely on educating folks so that they don't get exposed to these scams and not know what's coming at them.
Yeah. So do you see any like potential, I guess, policies coming in on, maybe not policies, but maybe a movement more towards the education around, you know, I guess that maybe even just the Board of Education, just period, where we're teaching about Bitcoin, we're teaching about hard money policies. Do you see that kind of integrating with all these changes that we're seeing into the government, where, you know, almost the school system, gets flipped a little bit on its head as well?
Yeah, I think certainly we should have education around the money we use, right? The problem is we don't have enough education around the financial sector and the financial system that we currently live under. I think schools would dramatically benefit from, you know, including some education around Bitcoin as time goes on. I know there's people working on that also as well.
Okay, so is that more at the state level? You don't have to necessarily say what it exactly states, but is the education aspects of it more at the state level opposed to the federal?
I'm not involved in those efforts directly, so I couldn't tell you for sure.
Okay. All right. Well, I want people to get to know. So we're going to get into some questions. I know you're from Portland, so we're going to have to get into some Portland stereotypes with you to tell me how true they are and how true they are not. The first one that comes to mind is that you guys are obsessed with coffee and how it is. So are you a big coffee nut? And if so, where do you think the best place to get coffee is?
Yeah, so definitely that there is a little bit of coffee snobbery here in Portland. And we also are very snobby about what goes into the drink as well. So you'll find a number of different places here that are great places to buy coffee. The most popular one is the Stumptown, for sure. And you couldn't go wrong buying coffee from them.
What's up, y'all? Come and join me down here in Medellin by going to the Bitcoin Medellin conference. It's January 17th and 18th. You can use promo code GreenCandle21 for 21% off. That's a huge discount, folks. It'll be cheaper. Everything in Colombia is a little bit cheaper. You can come down, hang out with the Colombianos, those chicas, and have a little fun. We can party it up here down in Medellin. So come on and join the fun. Come in, hang out with me, Luke Mikic, Jeff Booth, some of the other great speakers here. All right. I will see you guys all in Medellin. Back to the show.
All right. So do you have an aspect? Were you able to get any coffee while you're in El Salvador? You got to give me a rating on some of the beans down there if you were able to have some.
Also very good. Coffee, a lot of coffee exports out of that country. Tried a few places out. I couldn't name the brands for you right now, but that I tried. But yes, there's a lot. My mother has lived there for 15 years, as I said earlier, and she's a huge coffee nut coming from the Pacific Northwest. So she's very happy to be down there in El Salvador.
Yeah, I mean, some great ones. I think there was actually some panel just on like three different coffee companies that accept Bitcoin. So it's actually like a huge, huge growing movement there. So I'm excited to see how that kind of develops too in the Bitcoin space. But the other question I got, even on a Dennis, if you're Portland, it seems like everybody's just out there riding bikes. So do you own a car, or do you own like one of those dual bicycles where you got you and maybe a friend or something like that riding it with you?
A lot of bike riding here. I've got a bike, but yes, we own a car. One car to be specific.
No. What about a double decker bike? Do you own one of those?
No.
All right. One thing is, isn't Insomnia Cookies, wasn't that created down in Portland as well?
Oh, I think it was actually. It's possible. Actually, but there's also the Voodoo Donuts, which is the very popular down here. That's the one that's like very, very, very famous globally.
Yeah. So which one do you think is better? The Insomnia Donut or Insomnia Cookies or the Voodoo Donut?
I have Voodoo Donuts in my house right now. So I think that tells you the truth.
All right. So there you go. Are you eating a Voodoo Donut every single day or weekly? And what's your go-to when you go to Voodoo
Donuts? Yeah. You got to get the maple bacon bar. They put real bacon on top of the maple bar. It's incredible. You never would have realized how good it could be.
All right. And then do you actually prefer overcast over sunny weather? Because that's another stereotype I hear from people from Oregon.
I don't mind a few cool days with overcast, but I still love to get a little bit of sun exposure. So my travels help me get the sun that I need, though.
All right. And then we're coming up to the college football playoff. You guys got the Oregon Ducks up there, who are number two in the nation. I want you to go out on a limb. Do you think that the Oregon Ducks are going to win the college football national championship here?
Hey, listen, they haven't won it before, but I wouldn't count them out. I'm not a huge Ducks fan in the sense that I'm more so just not a college football guy. I'm more of an NFL guy, but I always root for the home team.
And then, all right, so if you're an NFL guy, then are you a Seattle Seahawks fan? I have to ask you a question on that. If so.
I have not had a big chance to follow the NFL this year, but I've been a Seahawks fan for a while. And also I used to be a Cowboys fan, but I've given up that ever since I realized that I hate Jerry Jones.
All right, good. Well, I'm away from the Cowboys stuff, but the Seahawks, they stole the 12th man from my alma mater. They stole the 12th man from Texas A&M. So I just want to hear an apology from it. Dennis, you guys are stealing some valor from us.
Hey, well, we might have taken it, but we perfected it. So you're welcome for popularizing it.
Oh, man. That one hurts a little bit. But, Dennis, you've been very generous with your time. I really appreciate you coming on there. And I'll let you get back to the donuts. But why don't you tell everybody where they can find out more about Satoshi Action Fund and what you guys got going on?
Yeah, definitely. Thank you again for having me on. They can go to satoshiaction.io if they want to look at all the work that we've been able to accomplish and also potentially donate to the work that we've done. You know, we have a big $500,000 donation goal that we're hitting this end of this year. We're pushing for the end of the year. We've got a bunch of people lined up to do match donations. So we're going to have $250,000 in match. So for every dollar that people give, they can double their impact and get a second dollar given by one of our match donors. If you want to reach out to us directly, you can reach out via email. It's help@satoshiaction.io.
And I'll put all that in the show notes. Be sure to support Dennis and Satoshi Action Fund because they're doing outstanding work. They're doing Satoshi's work to try to get everybody here in the U.S. very friendly to Bitcoin. So, Dennis, thank you for all that you do. And thanks for coming on the show. Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger, where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro-related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.